So when we think about the natural world, again, Holden is an ideal place to do that and to have this third session. And this is why I had this as the third session, because it's a good close for Thurman. But also, in some ways, what I want to talk about today and have us think about together is maybe Holden could be the worst place that we could have these conversations, because it is so tranquilic, it is so ideal, it is so apart. So moving forward, this is an image of the Atlantic Ocean at night. And what I want to do is speak a little bit to some of Thurman's experiences of the natural world. These are very well known in his life narrative, majority of them written about extensively by him in his autobiography with Head and Heart. Others of them I've just picked up in doing research on him. They span his life, and we're going to start with some from his childhood that if you were here in earlier sessions, you might remember. Howard Thurman grew up in Waycross, which was a black ghetto of Daytona, one of three black ghettos. And he grew up the third child, the only son in his family. Thurman grew up a black boy, but a very darkly pigmented black boy. His skin was darker than the majority of kids in his neighborhood. And Thurman also, as he grew up, he was pigeon-toed. And so when he started hanging out with his friends and playing games and getting out of school, you know, they would have all the time in the summer to go eat berries and go fishing and do these things. And so he would be the last one that was picked for teams because he wasn't really athletic. And also when they started, as I mentioned before, throwing rocks at dogs or kind of messing with the dogs and then trying to see what they can get away from them in his neighborhood, he was always the one that the dogs caught first because he was so slow. And so I share that along with the thought that we had the first session, that there's a good bit of scholarship that would suggest that Thurman's father, who he named as his father in his autobiography, Saul Thurman, the railroad man, was not, in fact, Howard Thurman's biological father. And that there was this gossip maybe going around Waycross as he was coming up about him being born out of wedlock and him there being a little bit of shame or a little bit of mystery around who he was. So you put those two together with any kid that's coming into his adolescent years or becoming a teenager, and you think, got to be a little bit awkward. But then you think about living as a black boy in the early 1900s in a black ghetto, Waycross, outside of Daytona, and your mother going into Daytona for her day job, doing laundry and doing house cleaning for white families, and you going in for some of your after-school work and a lot of your summer work in and out of that white community, and the idea that there is safe passage for whites during this time in their own community and into the black communities as much as they would want. But there's not as much bilateral kind of safe passage for an African-American into the white community when they don't have official work to do. So why am I talking about all of this in the Atlantic Ocean? It was at the Atlantic Ocean, at nightfall, not in the tranquil times, but for Thurman, as he writes in his biography, during the swelling up of storms, when he felt storms coming in the air, when he saw storms coming in the sky, when he had free time in the evening, I guess if it wasn't Sunday and they weren't at Baptist Church on Sunday nights, he would go down to this shore. And he would get his feet in the water and then the wet sand, and he would just stand there as the storm kind of developed. And what he writes about that in his autobiography is not this kind of mystical sense of kind of being at one with, you know, the wind, and I heard the dolphins cry, you know, all my ancestors and all this. The words that he used were much more intimate. Thurman said that he felt held and he felt understood. He said it was a climate of belonging. I felt held and I felt understood. And he would go on in that description, reflecting back on it as an adult. He had more fellowship in these experiences at the Atlantic Ocean than he did in the majority of his human relationships as a child and teenager. So for Thurman, it's beyond just images and concepts, but it gets down to those images and concepts that come out of his theology being rooted in his experiences. And certainly primary and maybe even primordial for him was the Atlantic Ocean night.
Question.
Yeah.
So that basically means he found peace there for himself. If you are living in chaos or fear, this was kind of a respite, a place of solitude that you could. I'm reading into
it. Yeah. I think that peace might be too. It might not be what he would say. I think what he would say was he found the solitude, and yet he wasn't alone in it. It was solitude rather than loneliness.
It was comfort.
Yeah, it was. He said comfort. Yeah. And so part of it is it was a place for him to kind of look at the chaos in his life and kind of feel it, without people needing him to do other things. Without, you know, the white press kind of saying you shouldn't be concerned about this, and to feel held and to feel understood could be comforting. And I would say rather than peace for Thurman, it was a place where he could kind of be in touch with all of his feelings, all of what it meant to be Thurman at that time. The only boy in his family, the brightest boy in his school, the questions about his biological father. And then his desires to do more than what was in Waycrosser's at that time. I don't think he got down there and it was kind of a zen out and I'm tranquil. I think it was a place where he could open up and kind of let down and be taken care of. Yeah, that's a great question, though. Another place, and this is funny, relative to kids and summer and playing, and I don't know if there have been any children or teens up here who needed medical attention and broken any arms or sprained ankles. But this is an image of the Halifax River. And the Halifax River was another vital place for Thurman as he grew up, especially as he was able to have permission to get out on a boat and to go fishing with some of his friends. And he loved being on this waterway that led out into the Atlantic Ocean. And one of the things that was interesting that he said in one of his writings on the issue of suffering, the fifth chapter called Suffering in his book called Disciplines of the Spirit, Thurman talks about how suffering is both a universal and also a very individual experience. It's something we can all relate to. And yet one of the things we never want to do when we're dealing with someone and their own suffering is saying, oh, I know exactly how you feel. You know, I've been there. Well, have you? You're right. Okay. Have you been to that? Okay. Thurman writes about that when suffering happens, even if we're not religious people, we ultimately want to try to find a reason for suffering. And the fancy theological or philosophical term for that is it's a question of theodicy. You know, what's the judgment or what's the divine will for this suffering? And Thurman said a very practical thing happened to him when he was 12. Been waiting all spring for the school year to be out. He's going to go pick blueberries, go hiking with his friends, go fishing on the Halifax River. Broke his right arm about a week before school got out. And in his mind, he was thinking, he said, I looked back over the last year and the last two or three years and thought, what was it that I must have done or I could have done to have this sort of punishment on me in the prime season of my summer of being out? So it was a treat for him. And when it was taken away from him, you know, because of an accident, he was wondering, you know, what was God limiting this for me for some reason? Was I being punished to not be able to engage? Halifax River, along with the Atlantic Ocean, pivotal for him as a child. One thing I can say about this briefly, too, in some of my own work on Thurman, Thurman said that he was always concerned in his ministry, and especially when he got to the Fellowship Church in San Francisco in the late 40s and back to Boston University in the 50s and 60s. These were much more kind of national and global posts to where he had a larger audience beyond the physical audience. Thurman was really concerned about children of the world, especially in war-torn issues, but children in America. And one of the words or phrases he used was he said, you know, we need to provide a windbreak. He would say we need to provide a windbreak for children, especially in times of great social change and cultural upheaval, Great Depression, the wars, internment camps with Japanese, not just for the Japanese children, but for American children to think about what this meant and to teach them well. But nature itself was somewhat of a windbreak for Thurman as a child. Again, along with his family, his maternal grandmother, Nancy Ambrose, his mother, Alice, the world of church and the world of nature were these places where he could be alone or be together with people and kind of have that room to experience his life. Spoke with one of you about this Lutheran feminist theologian just yesterday. I've used her in my work on Thurman pretty extensively, but Dorothy Zola talks about homeland, and she has the concept of homeland in writing about mysticism. And she says that there's something about the natural world as we're formed as young people before we kind of get too much into our rationale. And that even before we know it, there's something of the divine forming us and sensitizing us and kind of preparing us to come back to nature maybe as an adult with these intimacies, these senses of wonder, some of the things you all were talking about. And so while Waycross, the ghetto, was certainly Thurman's home, the Florida landscape was really his homeland in terms of these kind of connections with God that could provide salve for him, but also provide some material for him to teach from as he got older. Speaking of Thurman moving through and getting into his ministry, this is an image of the Khyber Pass on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is part of the Silk Road in terms of that whole travel of cultures coming together, of goods and fabrics and products being traded and brought over this stretch. It's in Pakistan. It's in Afghanistan, kind of right before you get to the border with Afghanistan. And Thurman came to the Khyber Pass during his pilgrimage of friendship that the YMCA had sponsored in the 1930s. He was there with his second wife, Sue Bailey Thurman, and they were there with another African-American religious couple. And this was one of the last places that they kind of had a day or two to be in before they started to turn back and get back toward the States. And just to give you a little bit of geography here in terms of thinking about where the Khyber Pass is a little bit more, we've got it right here. And so we can think about the borders of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And so the Khyber Pass was this route. And again, it was part of the Silk Road in terms of being very important for various epochs of international trade and travel. Certainly also, as we can see here, a beautiful place, you know, kind of mountain-esque and cavern-esque and desolate, but also kind of life-giving in a way. And here it is geographically. People who would want to really pinpoint certain mystical openings, or as the Quakers would just say, openings for Thurman in his life, would say, following his own writing about it, that he had an opening at Khyber Pass. And in my read of this, following Fluker and Smith, who came before me in interpreting his work, it was both the environmental setting, and then the way that this pathway has been made for cultures and for goods to be exchanged, the integration of those, this beautiful natural setting, and then these trails of people and goods and cultures coming together that really provided the font of this mystical opening for him. And what Thurman thought here, now if you remember anything from his chronology in earlier sessions, Thurman was about 2 years here from leaving Howard University and going to California to help start the Fellowship Church, right? Interracial, interfaith, more global reach. He said when he was here and he saw the people coming through, and then when he would reflect on the mountains, he was amazed at this one spot on earth that he was visiting during this pilgrimage, that there was so much ethnic diversity, there were so many languages being spoken among all the different people coming and going, because it was kind of that global crossroads, not only for products, but also for just travelers and some migration going on. And he said that began for him to be the seed of this inclusive vision that he felt Alfred Fisk, who invited him to nominate someone to help with the Fellowship Church, was going to be. And so what helped to seed this maybe? Being in Burma, being in Pakistan, being in India, being in Ceylon, during this time, meeting with Tagore at Ibadan, meeting with Gandhi, and then having this time when, again, it's nature, and then it's what's happening with the exchange of cultures and goods, the Khyber Pass vision. And Thurman doesn't say it was a vision, but he says it was the nearest to a vision that he had had. And what I can tell you about that in terms of looking at some of his journals is he doesn't talk about light, he doesn't talk about voices. There's just something he saw radiating kind of invisibly out of this energy of inclusivity, of cultures coming together, of the grandiosity of kind of the natural setting. And that's what he felt like after dedicating his career up to that point to being a black minister for, by and large, the black people in historically black educational and church settings, that he wanted to really begin to see this call to be more inclusive in his ministry, to continue to live out of his Negro idiom, to continue to work for the liberation and the equality of all people, but to do that in a way to where there could be more partnership among like-minded people of other races. And Khyber Pass was essential. And it wasn't in a cathedral. It wasn't with a religious statue. It wasn't reading something out of the Gospels. It wasn't the slave spirituals that he sang and got the vision. He got this vision. He had this opening in this environmental arena. Thurman never came to Holden, as I mentioned, right? He would have loved him, though, and I'll tell you why. He would have taken the slow boat both ways, and I'll tell you just a little bit why. And this is something I think about the cadence of nature for Thurman in the natural world. Thurman never learned to drive a car. This was unintentional for the first couple decades of his life, and then as he became well-known enough and had a little bit of some students that could help him get places, he decided he never wanted to learn to drive a car. Because he loved to be able to take his time getting places. And like, even if he was invited to speak a couple states over when he was out in San Francisco, or a couple states up, Pennsylvania, other places when he was in Georgia or D.C., he would take the train. And he said that unless he was really pressed to get there right away, he would take the train so that he could think first about who he was talking to, what he was talking about, and he could kind of just brood positively, you know, not anxiously over what he was going to say. So his message could kind of unfold as he was getting there. So the slow boat for Thurman. But he would have loved, I think, the thought of coming away from the world to get here. And then sets up something that Thurman writes about in kind of the postscripts in his autobiography. His autobiography has a section in the back of about 25 pages. Some of the little postscripts are titled, one word. Some of them have almost a sentence as the title. Some of them are paragraphs. Some of them are three pages. He writes one about a second dog that he had that was named after a Russian astronaut. He writes one of them about in later life wanting and being able to learn to play the clarinet and to oil paint. And that's where the penguins came from for him. He also writes about mountains. Grew up in Florida. Worked in right outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Worked in Washington, D.C. I've been in D.C. for almost 20 years now. I'm going to tell you, not a lot of mountains in Washington, D.C. Right? Maybe mountains of debt, but not a lot of mountains. In those postscripts, Thurman talks about various vocational paths that he didn't pursue. And one of them, he says, is that of being a therapist or an analyst, a psychoanalyst. You know, the idea of Freud and Erickson and Piaget and Jung kind of coming up in the 20th century. And as someone who's in my late 40s and kind of trained on some of those people in psychology and religion in college, I could take for granted that they were there as I was coming up as a child of the 70s. But for Thurman, this stuff was kind of new, you know, in the midst of how do you integrate this into your ministry as a clergy. Well, he didn't really get into a lot of analysis work in terms of training. He did know Freud's work well, and he did especially know his daughter Anna Freud, or Anna Freud's work, especially with children during times of conflict. So why mountains and why Holden for Thurman? well, if you come back next summer, I'm going to have his kids here and you can meet him in person. No. Thurman said that if he was going to be a talk therapist or be a psychoanalyst, and he could set up anywhere he wanted to, he said he would set up his office at the base of a large mountain or a large mountain range. And he said that part of the work that he would have every one of his clients do during their sessions is, depending on what he had notes on for the previous session, either to start or to end that session with them just being out in nature and having some quiet and just taking in that mountain. The age of what's out there. The material, the matter, you know, the form of that that's out there. If my kid's great uncle isn't trying to find raccoons or bears out there and yelling at them, the silence of that great structure. Then also, if you think about not just the fires that happened here several years ago, but also all that a mountain has endured, the seasons, the light, the winds, you know, the people coming up on it, the animals coming, and just what is it about intentionally bringing that into some sort of therapeutic practice that Thurman felt, that's what I would do. He could have written anything. I would prefer Adler. I would prefer Piaget. I would prefer Erickson's third crises. You know, that's what I really... No, here's my little section about what I might have done in the vocation, and here's what I'll tell you about it. I would have chosen to set up shop at the base of a mountain. And that would have been therapeutic, maybe more than anything else he could have done. So mountains. And if you haven't noticed yet, you know, got some pretty good ones around here. Mm-hmm. Right.
So is there any evidence that he had developed any mountains, or was it just kind of a dream of going?
Yeah. He had spent some time, he never lived on or near mountains a lot. He was married to Sue Bailey, his second wife. Very near my hometown in Gaston, North Carolina, they were married at Kings Mountain, North Carolina. And Kings Mountain is a baby mountain compared to these Cascades. But they honeymooned there for a bit. He also spent some time in Switzerland, and so saw some of those, didn't ski, didn't hike again. He wasn't one of those that would, but he would appreciate it. Right? Yeah.
That would do it.
Yeah. And what's interesting about him choosing the mountain, if he had turned his direction into being a psychoanalyst, is Thurman really was a waters man, really was a natural waters man. He really was a shoreline. That's where he began, and that's where he wanted to spend his days in San Francisco. But he would have chosen a mountain, he says, in terms of that therapeutic stance. As I've done in the last few sessions, these texts are the ones that you most explicitly will find Thurman even commenting on his own experience or giving his theology concerning the natural world. With Head and Heart is his biography, published in 81, shortly after his death. The Search for Common Ground is the text that I mentioned yesterday, and the primary chapter you would look for there would be called The Search in Living Structures. And what's interesting about that is he's certainly talking about creation myths a little bit, but he gets into cellular and smaller issues there in terms of what science of his day was positing about goal-seeking or about the potential of life, even at that smaller level. And then these three are all collections of his devotional writings that he would write on the back of the bulletin for the majority of services he presided over. And again, an hour before the service began, on Sunday at 11 or 10:30, he would have the chapel or the sanctuary open, quiet, choir was finished rehearsing, people were not to come in and gossip, and there would be a 1 to 3 or 4 paragraph reflection he had written on something they were talking about in the service and the current events of the week. And Deepest of Hunger was the first that was published, Centering Moment was the second, and Inward Journey was the third and final collection of those volumes. In those, he has interspersed these little meditations of 1 to 4 or 5 paragraphs that are specifically about nature, twilight, endless landscapes. He has others that are specifically about Jesus, the Jesus of history, and Jesus' encounter in the natural world. And then peppered throughout them, he also has his own experiences in the natural world. One I want to share with you that I think is a little bit idyllic, and as I mentioned, I think before, at least in a private conversation with some of you, Thurman would tend in some of his storytelling to embellish things. And he never saw this as being deceitful, but he would sometimes stretch or kind of have a largesse to something to make a point or to be a little bit more imaginative. Now, I haven't looked at this. I haven't found, talked to Luther Smith, talked to Walter Fluker, these earlier kind of groundbreaking Thurman scholars, and they weren't able to say yay or nay about this, but here's the story. Thurman was in Waycross. He was like fourth or fifth grade. It was the summer, and he was just playing at a friend's house, and then all of a sudden, the father of the house called him, and he got his attention quickly, and he asked Thurman to come out to the backyard, and what Thurman says happened was that there was a baby in this house, and just crawling around, not walking in the baby. And the baby was out in the backyard. And in the baby's lap and kind of in the baby's arms was a poison snake. The baby just been kind of out there, and the snake had just kind of come up. So Thurman says that the father asked Thurman to go to one side of the house and had his own son go to the other side of the house, because what the father was not wanting to have happen was to have anything to upset the balance right then, so that he could have just enough time to go get a blade or a hoe and to pull that snake away and kill it. And what Thurman talks about there is he talks about this age of innocence, to where we have this peaceable kingdom metaphor in a lot of our scriptural imagination, to where, you know, the adder or the snake can be there with the human and they can be at ease with one another, and they can be not a threat to one another. Now, for me, again, not knowing if that happened, that's amazing if that happened. It also sounds like quite a grand story as well. But the point that Thurman was making in that was the work that he and this man's son were doing of guarding the equilibrium, guarding the balance, guarding this lack of threat that at that point neither the child nor the snake felt. And then he says as soon as he was able, that father got that snake and killed it. So no one was prolonging it. I share that because what he talks about in here, and I think this is important for our discussion in a few minutes, Thurman didn't sentimentalize the natural world too much. I think that might have been more of an object lesson. But he certainly knew that wild is wild, and we don't want to try to domesticate it, even theologically, to have something to reflect on or feel good about. There was something other in nature, as well as there's being something intimate and something that we could relate to. And so in here, you're not just going to get beautiful kind of little sappy things that you can have an Instagram picture of and feel all good. You're also going to have him talking about the power and the mystery and some of the danger of wild. Might remember this from our last session. This is a late 19th century Auguste Rodin's sculpture out of marble, The Hand of God. And as I mentioned in this last time, this was a real metaphor for Thurman's notion of community, the word community, not the TV show. The notion community, not the concept of community that maybe 10 years ago and then the 15 years before that was just a catchword for everything. What are you looking for in a church? Oh, I'm looking for a community. What are you looking for in your workplace? Community. I want a sense of community. I'm a community person. I like to build community. Okay. Community. What about community? Okay. As you might remember from Wednesday, community was the term that Thurman talked about in the search for common ground. He felt like at the cellular and below the cellular level, and then even at that beyond Hubble Michael, you were talking about, that life's thrust is toward wholeness, toward wholemaking, at the organism and also the ecological level, and that he called that concept community. And I think he did that in order to make the relationship that he saw between what people were working to achieve among races in America and what people felt and experienced in their relationship with the natural world. We have three things here that are essential to that oneness or that community. One is the hand of the Creator, again, the right hand of the Creator. We have, secondly, the back of a male figure, and kind of holding the torso of the female figure, her hand coming up behind his neck, her feet coming up here. And where are his feet, and where's her head, and where's her other hand? They're still in the marble. And so the third thing we have here with Rodin is the matter, or the material, that creation is coming forth from. So we not only have the fusion of creator and creature, but we have the fusion of creator, creature, and the stuff of creation, or the matter. So let me ask a question here. And not judging, you can say your denominational background, you can say you had good teachers or bad teachers in this, you can say the Scopes Monkey Trial had everything or nothing to do with the way you formulated your faith as you were coming up as a Lutheran. But when we think about creator and creature, their relationship, or we think about creature and creation, I don't want you to think about this second term as just, you know, there's the cute little deer that have been out there, right? Or, Les, I want you to think about that second term as a big bear's come out there, right? Right?
Yeah.
The creature I want you to think about for this next question I'm up here is you. You're a creature. I'm a creature. Some of you chose the creature comforts of the comfy chair, so it's still there's comforts that we as creatures love. So when you think about the relationship between the creator, the creatures, and the larger creation, two choices. Do you think of yourself first and foremost as a part of the creator and the creation? Or do you think of yourself primarily as apart from the creator and the creation? Now, I'm not asking you how you think I want you to answer, or what Thurman thought, or maybe even what you think now you've been at Holden for a week. But let's track back 10 years. Let's track back 20 years. Let's track back 30 years. Just think for a bit about your faith as it's evolved and how you were taught either in Sunday school or high school, or family devotionals, or some of your mentors, about the natural world, for you as a person of faith, or you as a Christian. If you had to say the primary paradigm, was it that you love God and you love nature, but you kind of considered yourself as a part of creation and a part of God? Or that you love God and you love creation and you're supposed to take care of it, but you really kind of had this division in where you thought you were apart from it. And you were there, even to be someone who took care of it, but you were still apart from it. Any thoughts here? The floor is open.
Well, I guess for me, I was thinking you are the sinner that needs, you're a God's child, but you are a sinner that needs redeeming,
yeah,
and forgiveness, and you have to get the right order of God to be. So I might feel like I'm a creature, but to feel like it's a hard thing to feel too good about yourself because you are a sinner.
Okay.
But I think that as of this time in more as I've gotten older, probably I'm starting to think that I really do have something to offer and that I'm maybe a part of. But it's a little bit still. Because the old message from the 50s and the 60s,
yeah, yeah,
and all that, that's in great. That's all I knew.
Yeah.
That's the thing for me, my thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's still there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
Thank you.
It's a fight.
Yeah. Yes.
I always kind of wondered in this regard to be personal about it. My dad was spent his life as a meat packing plant, and at that time it was okay for family to go down on a tour through anytime we wanted to and watch the cattle being killed and the pigs being killed. And he was also a hunter and a fisherman, and he'd catch the fish, and without any betrayal of emotion, slice fillet, slice blood. And so I very early thought about a big chunk of creation that is other mammals and fish as things to be slaughtered.
Yeah. How did you feel? Did you have any memory, Michael, of what that was like for you? Was there ever a discomfort, or as you got older, did it get different?
Well, I could go on, but I don't want to dominate. Yeah, I'm sure it affected, with other things, my view of creatureliness and creation and my role.
Yeah. My grandfather was a head of the meat department at my local grocery store, and he would come home with, if I spent the night with him, I would see it, and I didn't get that close to it, though. Others. It can be in the middle, too. Yes, sir.
I guess I was...
This is important, given your work, too, for me to think about.
Yeah, I was going to say, to me, it's kind of an evolution, maybe, from a part from to a part of.
Okay.
From the standpoint of having a clear delineation of God and omnipotent and powerful, and yet separate, but yet at the same time realizing that you're part of that creation, and the here and now, the influence I have or others have on me, but at the same time realizing that you're forming the image and likeness, so it kind of tempers that a little bit, so it maybe kind of completes the circle a little bit more to me. Be a part of, but still realizing that I'm not God by any means.
Yeah,
from that perspective, but there's the touch points, I guess, and yet some evidence of separation.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So 2 decades ago, I served on the board of the Clarence Darrow Foundation in Chicago. It was very interesting. Now, you just put up this slide and made a connection for me that hadn't been there before. And one of the things that I was principally there, I worked at in a nonprofit community, and it was kind of standard practice for staff nonprofits to serve on the boards of foundations because it was part of the grant making process.
And giving back.
Giving back and all of that. But it really struck me at, intellectually, there were many things that I appreciated about the foundation and the perspective of Clarence Darrow and what they brought. They were very sterile, and they were definitely apart from almost everything. The gestalt that I got, just the internal sense that I got sitting in those board meetings, was that they had no, they were very well-connected lawyers and kind of the typical blue bloods of Chicago. But they had no grounding in nature, and almost, I don't know what the rest of their lives were like, but it seemed to me that they weren't really embedded in community in quite the same way. And maybe that's too broad of a brush or too much of a, looking back subjectively, your mind can do interesting things. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to put too much weight on it. It was 20 years ago, but it really struck me when you put up this slide that one of the things, the reasons I kind of backed out of that board was, among others, was that there didn't seem to be this collective. They wanted to do good, but there didn't seem to be this kind of collective embedded. They weren't collectively embedded in community or in nature.
Yeah. Oh yeah, thank you. Yeah. Something to think about, because I think especially for folks in the room here, it can be an evolution, and it can be kind of a progress or a process. And I asked this question in my spiritualized suffering class with some of my undergraduates when we look at natural disasters and acts of God. And they've come up already, I grew up on Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute. And that very famous and probably very kind of bitter but thankful and somewhat wealthy American Indian with the initial commercial where he's riding his horse and he's got the tear. Right? That was it for me. There was nothing in my church that said, you know, do this. It was give a hoot, don't pollute, and it was this American Indian, you know. And the combination for me was I was a part of and loved being a Lakota Sioux. Didn't know that, did you? In my bloodline. No. YMCA, Indian guys, right? bastardized in a lot of ways, you know, just did a horrible job in terms of repurposing a lot of American Indian life. But until I got old enough to realize that that wasn't right, I like being an Indian guide more than I like being a Boy Scout, because the story of being a part of rather than apart from. Just think on that. And again, maybe something to take back with you as we go down the mountain and reacclimatize. Right. Olive Schreiner, a primary poetic influence on Thurman, South African poet. Again, he was introduced to her during a student-led seminary retreat during his time at Colgate Rochester, by a white student he was colleagues with. Remember this guy from yesterday, or Wednesday maybe, artistic rendering of kind of the illumination and natural mysticism of Francis of Assisi. Mentioned that Thurman not only had a personal interest in him, but also under Rufus Jones at Haverford, the Quaker he studied with, and also with George Cross, the Canadian systematic theologian that he studied with at Colgate Rochester. Thurman read the medieval mystics, and really was interested in Francis's theology of creation. And then this guy again, Jesus as Pantocrator. Now again, I want to clarify, you're not going to find anything in Thurman to where he has an image or an art piece of Jesus that he loves. So I'm not saying, oh, I've discovered something new. Thurman loved the 6th century Mount Sinai Monastery of Egypt icon of Jesus. No. But I think that more so than just the black Jesus of history or the historical Jesus of the Jesus seminars that came up in the last 25 years of the 20th century, it was the mysterious kind of iconic Jesus of the scriptures that Thurman was most drawn to, especially in his nature mysticism. And I say that because, again, as I mentioned Wednesday, this image of Christ has a large and a small eye, and it's supposed to represent the paradox of being fully divine and fully human as the Word of God, the Word of God. And then there's the second idea of the Word of God here being the Scripture, right? And certainly that was vital for Martin Luther. You're going to lift this up. You're going to give this to people over and against the ritual and the hierarchy of the time. This was liberating. Relationship with the knowledge of this person and this experience was liberating. The Hebrew term where we get the notion of God speaking in the book of Genesis about God speaking creation into being is dabar, and at the root of that, and what that means is it's a dynamism, it's an energy, it's not just hey come up moon, but it's almost this sense that in God saying that the moon comes forth. It's not God calling it into being, but God is creating it through that word, and that word comes out of the divine mouth and is part of God extending to make the universe. There's another place that Schreiner, Francis, and the historical Jesus saw God's word fully alive, and that was in the natural setting. The reason that Thurman was so drawn to Schreiner, even though he never met her in his life, was her poetry was about a utopic human vision of reconciliation, of love and equality rather than fear and competition-based relationships. And by and large, the backdrop of those poems about the utopian human community was the natural world. So you can see that longing for community among peoples and that longing for community within nature being a real template for Thurman when he started his own poetry and his own sermonizing. So Schreiner, Francis and Jesus. I think primary mentors for Thurman, formally and informally. Do you see it?
Take a look.
Do you see it?
If you like this, I'm sorry, because this is not what it would have meant for Thurman to see Christ in creation. What this is, in my mind, is an objectification of nature to be a place where the face of God or the person of Christ can be projected. Instead of thinking about, again, going back here, the Word of God made flesh. The Word of God liberated by Luther. For Thurman, you don't need the Word of God to show up by a really good kind of yards keeper, right? Or someone who trims your bushes. Instead, this is what I think Thurman would have thought about. And he knew about this text toward his death, too. You know, you've heard this before, even if you saw it in a little Zen book on the back of some, you know, outhouse on the PCT that really you had thought it had nothing to do with Christianity. Right? Jesus says, I am all. For me all came forth, and to me all attained. Split a piece of wood, I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there. Guess what I have in my pocket? You ready? You ready to see some of my treasures from today?
Rocks.
Well, look. My daughters and my wife and I had some really rigorous trail food, a Kit Kat and some Tootsie Roll Pops for our break when we went out 2 miles on the trail. And I have found these ever since Magdalene was old enough to walk and go outside by herself in her pockets or my pockets almost every day I've cared for her rocks. She would call these her treasures. Just going to add them here. So you might know what this is. We have this great hymn, you know, about here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I've come. Right? And I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, I'll take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Ebenezer, not Dickens' character, but a fancy way of saying a stone of help that the Hebrews would build in their times of wandering in the wilderness and exile. Samuel focused them on it in the scriptures I remember most, so that as they or later generations would come by in their wandering spiritually and geographically, they could see those and say, these stones are a reminder of either when we or our ancestors stop to give thanks that God had provided a way for us. And so we don't, if you think about it, whether you have more of that sinfulness or you have a little bit more of that a part of, kind of moving in as you evolve, we don't need that face of Jesus manicured into with the greenery in our yard. You have your own altars in your own experiences, maybe as a child, maybe as a teenager, maybe even this week, to where maybe the Word of God or the Word of life has shown up for you. And maybe it actually got diminished if I ask you to focus on it too much in a theological concept, because it's just natural. It's just the natural world. So what I want to think of now as we prepare to take a short break is to give you a little bit of an overview of how we'll spend the rest of our time in the second hour. I've highlighted some of Thurman's experiences. I've talked about some of the importance of nature for him. We've had a little bit of discussion in the room about our relationship from a faith perspective or an analytical perspective about our relationship as creatures with creation. Well, when we come back, I want to start to think about how our relationships with the natural world can really be places where as Christians we can feel good about the way our theology informs them, that Thurman would probably say yes to. Or maybe there would be some places to where I, as an interpreter of Thurman, would say, the way that I think some Christians are interpreting God in nature. I hate it. That there's some ways that I think Christians are interpreting God's work in nature and are bringing nature into our lives of faith that I think are as destructive as global warming. Because it's an ideation that limits rather than deepens our relationship with the Creator. And if it limits rather than deepens our relationship with the Creator, then for me, it weakens rather than strengthens the ethical call to be stewards of the creation.
So did Thurman, did he stay in the Bay Area in San Francisco to the end of his life?
He did, yeah.
And when he finished with the ministry in San Francisco, how many years after that was, when did...
He had about 16 years, almost 16 full years between when he retired formally from the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples and then he died in 81. He didn't hold up. He was pastor emeritus of the Fellowship Church.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at their church meeting notes, but also his own correspondence, you'll see that even though he wasn't on the payroll, he still kind of was pretty active there. But his primary work was he set up something called the Howard Educational Trust, and it was a nonprofit that focused on scholarships and educational advocacy for African-American and minority students to college, and also to help to further disseminate his writings and audio recordings of his work.
So are there a lot of the voice recordings of his sermons like you've played for
there
us?
There are, and there are places, there are places, there's, I just recorded a little thing for a little podcast that they're going to put up in a couple weeks,
yeah.
And I name a little something there where you can find things. But
so that's accessible on the web?
It would be in a couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah, okay.
But then also, people can find me at Georgetown and I can put you in touch. But if you look up Boston University Thurman Archives, there is something called a virtual listening room now, Les.
Okay.
And what it is it's essentially all of the audio cassettes that I went 15 years ago now to go listen to myself when I was researching him. Technology has gotten to where his family is paid and given rights for those to be generally available to the public.
So online.
So you can go listen to him for free.
To
yeah, and there's a little 2 or 3 sentence descriptor, time, date, service, and then a little thematic of what he's talking about. But a warning, he lingers and there's a lot of silence. And so he might talk for 18 minutes, but the recording is going to be like 31 minutes long. Because he's slow.
And that was his style.
Yeah.
If you were in the pew listening to his preach.
You really had to.
He had that rhythm.
He did, yeah. So we're going to go ahead and get back to it. What I want to do is get started with this slide again. I wanted to get back to this slide because where did it go? Where's that bear? Oh, that's the wrong one. There it is. This bear, because I think, memes kind of ridicule things, but yeah, I mean there's a relationship, creature and creation and just, being at one instinctually. The panda has that over me as a walking, talking, thinking. Even though I love my emotive side, probably overly cerebral Homo sapien. And what I want to do to set off this next part, because what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about Thurman's concern for care of creation. And so I want to just say again a little bit the difference between these two memes for me. It is such a beautiful day. I hate it. And cats, maybe people are cat people or Siamese cats and you don't like it. But what I was going to argue was for Thurman, there are right and there are wrong ways, both in terms of stewardship, in terms of care and environmental causes, and I think also theologically, to interface with nature. And I think that we tend to think that sometimes anything we can do, whether it's contributing to a cause, going out and helping to, do some repair work or pick up litter, that all those things are always good for the earth and it's always the right thing to do and God really wants us to do that rather than do nothing. But there's also the mindset, there's also the theology, the way we think about our relationship with the natural world And, you know, the danger with slavery, which was one of the major ills of the 20th century and one of the primary, you know, psychic scars on Thurman and his family, was a theological issue. It was, it wasn't so much, well, you know, we know this doesn't feel good, but kind of it's what the Word says and what we've been taught, and this must be how we interpret the Bible. But it was, it wasn't just an activism that solved it. It was a rethinking our relationship with the problem from a faith perspective. And so what I want to read briefly here is just a little bit of my own research relative to Thurman and the natural world. And I promise I won't bore you because it's not very long. But I want to just read a little bit of some things that were deeper in his writing than you would find in a cursory glance, or if you just happen to kind of read through his work looking for devotion. In this, I'm talking about four areas of care for peace and peacemaking that I felt Thurman had, along with racism and segregation. He also did a good bit of thinking and talking about and praying concerning the issues of poverty and materialism. He also, although not being an activist, was quite a pacifist in terms of being an anti-war preacher, especially against the Second World War. And then the fourth sign of the times, the other image of rupture that he really was concerned with and anticipated in this, the ecological movement of the 60s and 70s, and then also with that into the 80s, deep ecology, both in terms of academics and activists, was what he called a pillage nature. And so I just want to read a little bit here for you. Just read a little bit here. He says, in line with his more specific concerns with military conflict, Thurman believed violence of war caused deep rupture between humanity and the environment. So when we have war, when we movement machinery, when we destroy towns and villages, we're also upsetting the natural balance. Yet violence done to the earth through military conflict was simply one of a number of signs for him that the human organism, over the long pull of advancing civilizations, had forgotten its primal rootedness in creation, so richly witnessed to in the creation myths and histories of earlier cultures. Like the magnificence of the human mind, Thurman reckoned one of its most deceptive aspects of the individual is not only distinct from, but even more stridently over and against nature. So Thurman certainly felt that he as a creature and the people that God intended us to be were more part of than apart from nature. And he says, from such a domineering consciousness, he wrote, and I quote, it is but a single leap to regard nature as being so completely other than himself that he might exploit it, plunder it, and rape it with impunity. And then he goes on to say about how modern industrial society had furthered this divorce. And let me quote again. Our atmosphere is polluted, our streams are poisoned, our hills are denuded. Wildlife is increasingly exterminated, while more and more man becomes an alien on the earth and a fowler of his own nest. And then the final thing I'll mention here in terms of a quote from him, this is from his text, Search for Common Ground. And he was concerned with psychology as it developed as its own specialty and how he could accommodate into his pastoral work. But he wrote about kind of healthcare and health issues in America. And here's a little bit of what he said. While previous scholarship has largely focused on Thurman's analysis of the negative social and psychological affects of segregation, he also maintained that human separation from nature and humanity's, quote, will to dominate, end quote, rather than cultivate life, increased mental and emotional sickness more than any other economic, social, or political ill. So he's arguing that our divorce from the natural world was not just a psychic scar, but it was manifesting in our economics and our cultural wars. He writes this, and I quote, the collective psyche shrieks with the agony that it feels as part of the death cry of a pillaged nature. Again, let me quote. The collective psyche, that's that of America and the mid-20th century, shrieks with the agony that it feels as part of the death cry of a pillaged nature. this was not his main thing. He was not, you know, Francis of Assisi during his day repairing the church, saying the earth is important. He was not Wendelberry. He was not Dorothy Zola. He was not, the environmental movement. But this concern of nature was not just inspiration for him. It was a real sign of the rupture of our sinfulness. And he was concerned that as Christians, we learn to think about as well as act with nature in appropriate ways. And so this is about the idea of me channeling this cat, saying that when we make nature an object of devotion in which we can see God rather than experience God as already a part of nature, we don't need to project or inject God there, we're doing a disservice to the Creator, because we're almost saying we need to put you into nature to worship you there. And we're certainly doing a disservice to the natural world, because we're saying your substance is only really worth it to us as people of faith when we can ask God to be in you, or bring our imagination that God is in you. Because God, as a creator, is already filling the creation. And what I'd like to do to get us ready to go outside for the last little bit is share with you the words and also the original recording of a piece that has gotten me through in my seminary days with the natural world. This is a piece by the folk duo who plays together, but not as much anymore, the Indigo Girls, Emily Chaliers and Amy Ray. This is off of their album called Indians, Nomads, and Saints. And this is a piece that I think is appropriate about adoring nature as a way of seeing it as a way to get back into God's heaven and into a relationship with God that is natural to how Thurman would have believed. So let me get the music going, and then I'll give you some of these words. After this, I want to show one more slide, and then I've got a handout to take us all outside for the remaining time.
Turning all my blues to black. I'm
about this piece of music? Just the wording, the music, relationship to what we talked about, or if you know it well?
I've heard them sing many a time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
I like the phrase, everywhere I turn, all the beauty just keeps shaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
If the world was meant for me, don't bury me, carry me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I was a normal Indian or a saint. I love that.
Nomad and Indian or saint, yeah.
Disappear, leave me nothing to take.
I'm struck by the sense of going back to the apart from or of, so the sense of belonging, and this world was meant for me, and then also, you know, the world falling on me and the world shaking me, so this also this notion of its immensity and almost the potential to, you know, that disruption, that storm. So it's like I hear consolation and I also hear the intimacy of consolation and also the intimacy of possibility that, like, this might undo me here.
Yeah, yeah.
It might fall on me.
Yeah.
So.
Or the Andrews, who said Jarvis?
Indian philosopher, 19th century. I think that Amy Ray, the Baptist, found him in college, maybe in a philosophy class. I share this with you just because I think it's appropriate for a little bit of the joy and the incarnation and just the rhythm of this song. I also share it with you because I think that more so than some of Thurman's favorite hymns, which are more meditative and slow, Thurman wasn't just a slow, contemplative guy. He laughed, he had fun, he was very gregarious, and I think he would appreciate this. I want to share two quick things with you here about this song, and then I'll lead us into our outdoor experience. My seminary, Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond, which began in 1991, and I was the second class that came through, one of the real unique things of our curriculum at that time was that we required all students to go on a mission immersion experience. So second year of your study, your middle year, part of your tuition covered going for 4 to 6 weeks to another culture, sometimes in the state, sometimes globally, not to do ministry, not to preach, not to evangelize, but to observe and to learn. And I was fortunate that I was there and slotted for a trip to go to Israel and Palestine. And so I got to go there with about 14 other students and two faculty. And I still run today. I don't run as many miles as I used to. I don't run as fast as I used to. But back then in my early 20s, I was doing a couple marathons a year, running all the time. And I didn't have that many things I wanted to pack. So I just wore my running tights, my clothes, and I had on my hiking boots. And every night after supper, whether we were in a big city or out kind of an outpost, a little hostel type place, I would take about 45 minutes and go for a run. And I loved it because we were doing some work with helping to build up some homes in an orphanage for Muslim children and other children who had lost their families through some of the conflict. We had a lot of speakers, a lot of this heady kind of stuff we're doing here with me now. And I just wanted to get away from everybody. And I didn't want to go on an official tour of a sacred site. I just wanted to kind of be out there in the landscape. And I loved it. And I had a cassette player back then. And this album was all that I listened to during that trip because I listened to it right before I got off the bus the first time I took my run. And I just carried this song and another one about nature with me. And I just thought, you know, all this conflict, look at this beautiful. So that's why I brought it in here, too, to tie into another anecdote from my life. The Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation, which is a well-known place to train people in spirituality ministries and spiritual direction particularly, I was on their board for a while, but I also finished their group leaders program, so where you learn to do contemplative practices with people. And we had a man come in to present a seminar on earth spirituality. Scientist, biologist, high school biology teacher, had given his life in retirement to teaching with the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. about care for the creation. And he had set us up with some great tours through some of the, we were at a retreat center, so we went on some nature hikes and had some silence there. And we came back together by this altar we're not going to replicate it here, but he asked us to have some prayers of desolation and prayers of confession individually and as a human collective about our relationship with nature. And he had these images of Valdez and, you know, not recycling and the idea of, you know, food deserts and just all this kind of stuff. And it was a lot. And I didn't tear up, but I usually am not really emotive in these places, but I couldn't move past that. And then about 30 minutes later, after kind of being there in this place and people sharing things or praying things or offering things verbally that we wanted to confess, he asked, what about prayers of consolation or prayers of thanksgiving to God for the earth, for the creation? And what we had to do was, when we were ready to do that, we had to move off of a certain part of the floor where he had set apart of desolation and confession into a place of thanksgiving and praise. Now, I hadn't planned this, but I couldn't move. I really could. I chose not to move. And his name was Doug. And he asked me, what's going on? I just can't move. And I think some of it's because I know I could be doing more and be thinking more, but also just devastating to me to think about the large project of really caring for nature as a part of it, being a caregiver, because we feel like we can do so many little things, you know, and even carbon, paying off our carbon taxes and all that stuff. But just, you know, and as I become a parent, I mean, my girls and I were out in that world today. And what's becoming of this world? So when we think about that, go back to this real quick. I don't hate that it's a beautiful day, but I hate when well-meaning Christians will take more of a activism-based approach to caring for God's creation that makes us feel better because we're doing things, rather than also tying into that a way of rethinking how we are in relationship to the environment. Because it's not just an action, it's a lifestyle. And that lifestyle has to be bathed in prayer and bathed in evolving practice, and I think bathed in a balance of confession and thanksgiving. And so when I say that, I think about these things today. And we could say very easily, depending on which side of the current political climate we're at in our country, that some are more at fault than others. But before the current administration was in place, and before the one that was in place before that one, and before the one that was in place before that one, going back to early 2000s, we were already at the tipping point for a lot of what we have domestically and globally now. The collective psyche shrieks because it hears the death cry of a pillaged nature. That's what Thurman wrote in the 60s. More people are in hospital beds in the American healthcare delivery system as an implicit consequence of our divorce from the natural world than of any sort of lack of appropriate diet or exercise. That was his argument in the 60s. So what about this stuff, you know? And I put this up here as kind of a shock value to say, I think whenever we minimize the work that God asks us to do for creation, and I think Thurman would be behind, it's almost in the sense of saying, if we can teach our kids in VBS to save a little water, or if we can talk about, you know, the Psalms that talk about the beauty of the mountains, or if we can think about the idea that joy comes in the morning, as the scripture says, and isn't it beautiful that the sun's there, and that means God always gives us a new beginning. That's not just not enough. For me, that's sinful and anemic in terms of the response that Thurman would want us to make. And I think we can be, as people of God, to being responsible stewards of this planet, of this creation. So what I'm going to do You're welcome for making everyone feel really good coming back to the second hour here. Is think about what this guy would say here relative to some of these questions. What are you most curious about or drawn to concerning his relationship with the natural world, or either his experiences or his theology? How has the larger creation impacted your life, specifically your spirituality? And then how does his conception of the natural world and of stewardship compare to your own ecological views? Maybe you would say, Thurman, we need to do even more. Come on, Ridgeway. Turn it up to 11. So these are some questions you can take with you if you want. I encourage you to do is maybe just let one of them imprint on you as we're in the room together. And then I have some handouts. And these handouts are two readings again, but they're two I want you to read in tandem to one another if you'd like. As much as any of these questions can be a guide, or one or both of these readings can be a guide. The first one is called Twilight and Endless Landscapes. The second one is called To Make a Rest of Motion. Great. But what I would invite you to do, as you'd like, is take maybe the next 15 minutes, so we'll come back in at about 20 to 25 till, to go outside. Think on one of these questions, take one of these handouts and read it reflectively. Find a tree. You can wander out the path to the right out there to the creek. And Thanksgiving or confession. Thank you, God, for this. Forgive me, God, for help me better listen, help me better serve. And we'll come back in and just have a couple minutes of silence together to kind of honor whatever's happened with you individually before we dismiss for the week. Okay? So here these are if you're interested. I'll just leave them right here on the table. And what I'll do is come out the back near the pottery studio and ring my chimes three times to let you know if you'd like, you can come back in. Two there. Well, thanks for coming back in and mindful of the time. So it was just a little mini excursion there that you had. I have in my graduate course on bioethics for advanced practice nurses that I teach each semester. I meet online with 12 students 2 hours a week, and it's virtual. And we have 60 seconds at the beginning of each session to where I'll offer a quote or a poem or a question, and they just have 60 seconds to reflect. And I joke with them at the second session to say, you know, sorry I didn't get that travel grant in on time to take all of you at the end of the semester to Tibet for a weekend-long silent meditation, you know, or whatever, you know, tea and everything. So I just have these 60 seconds each week. And I know that was nothing. I wasn't trying to get you on any sort of mystical or, you know, kind of insight transmission space. Just wanted to at least get your feet and your mind out into what we've been talking about so much in here today. I'll say two things quickly just to clarify and then ask for any feedback on these before we dismiss. One was, when I was talking earlier and saying that I felt like, you know, to do the VBS craft or to talk about, you know, God in the Psalms or to talk about, you know, the promise of a new day or resurrection and the sun always coming up. I didn't mean to diminish those things, but my notion of that being maybe even sinful from a Christian perspective of caregiving or being a steward would be akin to this. We go back down the mountain from Holden and in this environmental place and say, wow, I feel so relaxed. I was in nature. It was so peaceful. It just helped me feel closer to God. And we don't remember anything of what either I was confronted with and learned about composting and not wasting food and being mindful with water and being mindful about how close I am with even the deer that come into my yard because of the way the neighbors are being built, right? So it wasn't a diminishment to say don't do anything, but it's saying it can't all be spiritualized and that there's something of organizing, there's something of studying policy, there's something of bringing geology and ecology into our Bible studies that not only should help us kind of pray better for the earth, but I think be active stewards of the earth. And the second thing I wanted to clarify, and not apologize for at all, I do really well, I think, as a public speaker, and I love teaching. The only times that I regularly get verklempt is when I think about my wife or my daughters. And I did that today. And I don't apologize for that, but for me that was just a felt sense of what will be their responsibility in terms of maybe even not having the chance of being a teenager in an innocence of just enjoying the world for itself rather than thinking about how to save it and not not have it be exploited so that they can continue to live their full life on it. We just got a few more minutes here, if you don't mind. Thank you. Any comments on any of these questions that you might have taken with you, or any final comments about Thurman today and the natural world as we're finishing up?
Good question. The one you wrote in your book.
Yeah.
Was that in the 20s? When you wrote what he said?
No, he was writing that in the 60s.
Oh, in the 60s.
Yes.
I thought he said the 20s. I was just curious.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also, when you were talking, I think that shows love.
Yeah.
It shows love to you. I feel love for me when you were talking. So that's all I'm saying.
I'm strong to... I went out and was reading,
mm-hmm.
and I was drawn to his reflection on pause and stop. And that's so important. I think that's very, we don't do enough of that, I think, in my own, I don't do enough of that in my own regular life. You know, and I think that, you know, for myself has given me, being up here has given me pause and stop, because then we can reflect on what our next step might be. I think that was really important. I think his words were very important as I was out there and looking at pause and stopping and observing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
The second one there kind of gave me the kind of this wonder and awe type thing. And, you know, part of my previous work, and I still try to do now, is just try to maintain what we've got and try not to lose it and try to advocate perhaps some of the things you're talking about. But there's two other things you kind of brought up about the role, the natural world for people and, you know, problems with healthcare and what have you. There are a number of doctors now that actually are trying to prescribe getting outside, you know, whether it's to relieve stress or, you know, if you're recovering from a disease, be it cancer or anything else, to really try to relieve yourself from what's bothering you. And the other thing, there was a book, I'm trying to remember the title, I think it was No Child in the Woods or something like that, which
Last
is...
Last Child in the Woods?
Last Child. Yes. Mm-hmm. Is the fact, you know, a lot of the kids being disconnected. And, you know, a lot of times I kind of come away from some of these things kind of wondering, okay, so now what do you do? You know, there's a lot of despair and negative and, you know, outside just complaining. But that's one aspect that either as adults, parents, grandparents, or whatever, is just trying to encourage the kids to get back outside. Because, you know, a lot of that's been kind of lost, and a lot of times we're always talking about educating our kids and what have you. But if there's a way to get them reconnected, because granted, there's things we as adults can do to try to vote and change policy, but if they don't see the need themselves somewhere down the line, everything that you set up might be for naught. So, you know, unless they have the will or the need or see the... So I guess I would just encourage people.
Yeah.
And that's something that you can try to do. You know, just walking your hand down the creek and throwing rocks or picking up a bug or something.
It has to be raised intrinsically in that.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's got to come from you. You can't just say, you need to go out in the woods.
You mean you as parents, or yeah. us as guides?
Or as you as a teacher, former teacher. You can't just tell them that. It's got to yeah. come from them.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And there are these kind of unthought of things like sound, but the kids losing their hearing early, and it's, you know, rock music and echoed sound and no silence of nature. And who is it? Aldous Huxley started this movement that one of the causes of nearsightedness, this is still challengeable, but it's possible, is the lack of ever looking far away to see horizons or looking long distances. But if you never go outside, the farthest I see is that wall. My eyes adjust and lose sight ability because I never look like I hear. I look at the mountains, but I've got to go outside to do that. So.
Mm.
Well, after I got over the fact, walking out the door and down the steps, I got a sliver in my hand, thinking that, wait a minute, I'm not sure about this going out into the natural world is a smart idea for me. But I was reading, and when Thurman talked about twilights and the perspective in the desert and the open ground, and then from the city perspective, seeing twilight with two perspectives. I was sitting on a log next to the creek, and as I looked straight down, you could see the bottom of the creek and all the rocks all across and the water rushing over it. And my initial thought process about that was reminding me of what we're doing to creation and how we're destroying creation with such force and power. And those rocks could be trying to stop that, but it just pours right over them. And very difficult to get rocks mm-hmm. together to have an impact. And then on the flip side, looking up the stream, you can't see the bottom and all the rocks. All you see is the bubbly, gurgly, forceful water coming down with the sun shining off it and life-giving water coming. So now the creek changed in its perspective for me in seeing a very life-giving thing and a uplifting thing, not a depressing thing, kind of going back to the example you used earlier. And all in the same creek, run right in front of me, looking at it differently. So that resonated for me.
In that piece on twilight, I love twilight. I think twilight's a beautiful time of the day and brings so much, just in terms of kind of a sense of, well-being, but you know, as he talks about that balance, you need the light and the darkness and that balance between it, and then the largeness of creation and the enduring of creation and our place in it. We think we're big, we think we're important, and we're so small, and maybe we won't exist, but maybe creation will still be there, that twilight will still be there. And it doesn't absolve us of our responsibility to do what we do, but it puts into perspective. And it also it's kind of that thing that, yeah, every little piece is also important, you know, that we've got the cosmos and we've got the huge, but it comes down to the very cellular level. And all of that in between, and the balance between that, and it's magnificent. It's overwhelming. It's challenging. It's life affirming. It's all of those. I mean, and without that, to me, it points to, you know, having studied sciences, I could never, in the study of science, I couldn't understand how scientists would say there's this divide between science and religion. And, you know, to me, how can you divide the two? If you study science, how could you ever think there is not something above this and see that whole cosmos and a creator, and then finding your place in that and how you deal with it?
No, you're not. No. I'm mindful of time, and I think another group might need the room. Last thing I'll say is, my family and I will be here through tomorrow morning. You can always find me through Georgetown, but if you're interested in getting a little handout from me, I won't send anything else to you, maybe in a month. It's just, if you want to know more about this, this, or this, these are the places to go online or in Thurman's text. I have a place where if you want to give me your email, I will just get that out to everybody once, and I won't bother you anymore about what I find in my pockets a month from now for my daughter. So I'll leave this on the back one. Thanks for your time this week very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.